it is really with great pleasure and honor that we have Mr. Lanier here, and I am delighted to introduce him to you. As many of you know, Mr. Lanier is the founder of the Lanier Law Firm. It is an elite plaintiff side trial firm, and they have won awards from the jury in the billions today. And in 2 weeks, Ms. Lanier will be leading the opioid trials in Ohio. It's not, I think, an exaggeration to say that plaintiff side work is tough. You are always the David, which actually, in biblical terms, may be the good thing. But there's no question that the pressure and the possibility of having an easier professional life is always there. It's always a temptation to jump to the defense side. The Lanier Law Firm has taken on cases that most lawyers have said are impossible to win. And if they're impossible to win, then as a lawyer, you can't get paid. And so that means you shouldn't take them on. And I think that both as a testament to his faith, but also really a testament to what that faith has caused him to think about in terms of justice for Americans, has been vital for this season that we're in our legal profession. And so it is with great honor I ask you to join me in inviting Mr. Lanier to the podium.
Thank you so much. Boy, that was so kind. And I understand this is going to be videoed, which is always a joy for me because I get the strangest reactions when things are videoed. I taught a torts class at Harvard a number of years ago, and it was videoed. And the video is posted, and it's called Tort War Stories. And videos are like children in a sense. A speech is like a child in a sense. You conceive it. You bring it into this world. You nurture it. You pour yourself into it. And then at some point, you send it out. And it's gone. And it goes out and it makes its own friends and its own enemies. And you look at some of them and you think, I'm really proud of my kid. That's good. And you look at some of them, you kind of cringe and think, I reared that. I brought that into this world. That's hideous. And so it, I don't know where this one goes. I don't know what happens, but you're here. I'm here. So let's get through it anyway. Fair. We'll do it. So here is the topic, the challenge of justice for all. Now I'm going to speak for a while. And then when you start looking like you're restless, I'm going to quit speaking and we're going to do Q&A for anybody who may have some questions. If you don't have any, I can supply those as well. It's full service from start to finish. All people who grow up in the United States of America are familiar with the following. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God. Hello, Chaim. Indivisible. That hello, Chaim is not in the Pledge of Allegiance. In case some of you are just sort of wandering, okay? That was an ad. One and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Justice for all is in our pledge of allegiance. It is that final proclamation after which we can put a period and say, I say no more. So where does this come from? Why is it so hard for us to find justice for all? Because it is hard. It's extremely hard. Excuse the way this slide comes down. Get that up there first. Where did we get this idea of justice for all? That's the first thing I want to talk to you about. And then the second thing I want to talk to you about in true red, white, and blue fashion is going to be, what does it take to get justice for all? And then the third thing I would like to address with you is the very simple, what are the fruits of justice for all? So with that as my roadmap of where we'll go this evening, let's start with the first. Where did we get this idea of justice for all? Does anybody have any clue where it came from? Don't worry, I don't cold call on you. This is not class. I just will let you sit there and say, I don't know. So let me tell you where it did not come from. We are a Western civilization country, and by that, we derive our historical values generally from the Roman Empire. However, justice for all is not a Roman concept. The Romans did not have justice for all. The Romans had a kind of justice for the elite. But the justice was very much dependent upon social stratus. Strata. Social status or strata. Or if you combine those words, social stratus. The idea of there were basically three Roman classes. And those classes got subdivided into other classes. And you were allowed to have justice if you were in certain classes. If you were in the bottom class of a slave, there was no justice. You were chattel. You were like an ox, a dog, a cat. And you no more got justice than an ox, a dog, or a cat. You want to kill an ox? Have a big barbecue with your friends? Go for it. The ox cannot say, if you kill me, I will sue you. Doesn't happen. Doesn't have the right. Now, above the slave, above the chattel, were the non-citizens. The non-citizens had better rights than the slaves. But the rights were still not rights to full justice in court. A non-citizen could take another non-citizen to court during one stretch of the Roman Empire, but did not have full justice rights. And then above that would be the citizens of Rome. Don't think of the Roman Empire citizens as citizens of the United States, where it's, hey, I'm a United States citizen regardless of where I hail from. A Roman citizen was not a citizen of the empire. They were a citizen of Rome, which meant they could vote for the emperor. Or the Senate, I should say. They could vote in a Roman election. And throughout the Roman Empire, the citizens of Rome had certain rights. But those rights were subdivided. And if, for example, you were born a Roman citizen, you had more rights than someone who bought their Roman citizenship. Why was that important? If you wanted to seek justice in a court system, this is my daughter who just gave birth to our first grandchild.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm glad to FaceTime you. This is the audience at Harvard I'm speaking to. Show them the grandbaby. Tell them hello.
Hello.
I love you. Can I call you back in a bit? Bye, sweetie. I'm proud of you. Okay. Thank you. I would normally have canceled, but she said, Dad, go talk to them, because she went into labor as I got on the plane this morning. So that's my first time to talk to my daughter now that she's a mom. Anyway, I'm glad we've had this family moment. Let's get back to where we were. So within this stratus of Roman citizenship, if you were at a higher level because you were born a citizen than someone who bought a citizenship, you had justice against those below you, everybody below you. But you could never get justice of those above you. If you had bought your citizenship, you could not sit in judgment on a citizen who inherited their citizenship. Couldn't happen. In fact, if you got out, where you sat in a game, in one of the theaters where they'd have the games, where you sat was dependent upon your status as a citizen. It wasn't like, hey, I'm going to get here early. I'm going to get me a good seat. You sit in the wrong section, you are subject to forfeiture of your citizenship. Unless you're not a citizen yet, you're subject to forfeiture of your life. They drew those types of distinctions. Justice for all is not something that we put into the United States because we inherited it from Roman law. We did not. Now, that's not to say that it's a new concept. That's not to say that we in the 18th century decided that we were going to do something really novel and cool and treat people fairly. In the Old Testament, which means we're looking at a time of history that deals with Israel, you can go back 500-600 years. You can look at some of the prophets, and they spoke of justice for all. The Jewish prophets wrote about justice for all because it was a concern of theirs. Amos would talk about the need to let justice roll down like heavy waters. The prophet Micah asked an interesting question. What does the Lord require of you? His answer, first and foremost, to do justice. Love mercy and walk humbly with your God. The idea of justice for everyone, and Micah and Amos and others were concerned that it's not just justice for the rich, not just justice for the powerful, not just justice for the well-to-do, not just justice for the bon vivants, it's justice for all. The widows, the orphans, the foreigners, the strangers, everybody. Bizarro concept, by the way, since we're just here as family, sharing in the birth of John Henry Thee the Fourth. Can I tell you one story about this passage? Okay, thank you. Hearing no objection. I rarely quote scripture in trial. I've tried cases for 35 years, more cases than I can count, spent more time in my life in trial than anybody I know, but I rarely quote scripture in trial. Now, please understand. My undergraduate degree is basically translating the Bible. I have an undergraduate degree in Hebrew and Greek. I translated the Bible for 4 years of schooling. I've taught the Bible all my life. I have a pretty decent knowledge of Scripture, but I don't quote it in trial. It's just not what I do. Except a few times. So one time I was trying a case in this small little county in Wharton, Texas. Wharton is, it's a one Dairy Queen town, as we would call it. It's one of these towns that's just like got one Dairy Queen in it. It's not big enough to have two. And in Texas, sometimes we measure towns by how many Dairy Queens are there. Cambridge would be like an 8 Dairy Queen town, easy. Okay. Boston, the greater Boston area. More Dairy Queens than you can count if it were in Texas. But Angleton's about a one Dairy Queen town. And so I'm set to try the case while I show up to pick the jury. Now, y'all will learn in your trial classes, if you haven't already, that jury selection is called voir dire in everywhere except Texas. There it's voir dire. And so I'm voir dire in the jury. And that's the way we say it, okay? Because mama ain't going to speak no French. So it's voir dire. So I'm there to voir dire the jury. Now, there are four rows of potential jurors. And Massachusetts does not allow lawyers to conduct voir dire. But in Texas, lawyers do voir dire. And we're allowed to conduct it. So I'm going to stand up and I'm going to ask those potential jurors, Hannah, where are you from? Ah, Dallas, where'd you go to high school? Hockaday. Well, now that's interesting. That's an all-girls school where the dance is fun. You know, I'm allowed to ask questions like that. And I decide which jurors I want. Now, you don't select a jury. You don't say, I'm going to take him. I'm going to take her. I want him. I don't want him. He looks goofy. I want him. You don't look goofy, sir. I was just using you as an example. And you don't select jurors. You
deselect jurors. You say, I don't know who I'm going to get, but I don't want that one, and I don't want number four, and I don't want number seven. And then the first 12 that are left become the jurors. Got it? So I'm up there. I'm doing jury selection. Second row, dead center, is the pastor of the big Baptist church in this one Dairy Queen town. And I know he knows everybody. He's been the pastor of that church for 30 years. And everybody knows him. And if he's been the pastor of that church for 30 years, I figure at least 80% of the jury is going to be in his church, because it's the big church in town. And if they're in his church, they're not going to cross what the pastor says. I mean, that's like if you're Catholic and you get the Pope on your jury and you're serving with the Pope, you're going to sit there and say, no, Your Holiness, you've got this wrong. You know, you just generally figure it's not going to happen, right? And as a result, pastors never get put on juries very often. So I said to him, I said, Pastor so-and-so, he says, yes. I said, you come down here for jury selection often? He says, quite a few times. I said, how often you make the jury? He says, never. I said, you got any idea why? He says, I've got suspicions. I said, let me tell you why. I said, how many of these jurors you know? He looks around, he says, all of them. How many of these people go to church with you? Almost all of them. I said, you see, we have a jury system because we want 12 people to collectively think through the evidence and come to a collective decision. But when you are the kind of leader you are, the fear of lawyers is that it will become a jury of one person and they'll do whatever you tell them to do. And I said, so lawyers don't want to put you on a jury unless the lawyer knows you're going to vote their way. He said, that makes sense to me. I said, so my job is to figure out which way you're going to vote. He said, that makes sense to me. I said, so let me ask you a couple questions. I said, what'd you preach on last Sunday? He said, the love of Jesus. I said, were you for it or against it? He said, I was for it. And I said, okay, that's good. I said, let me ask you this one. Do you believe in the difference between right and wrong? He said, yes. I said, what is lying? He said, wrong. I said, every time? He goes, every time. I said, without fail? He said, without fail. I said, what if somebody wants to lie so that they can get out of a bad situation in a lawsuit? What if they want to lie to defend themselves in a lawsuit? Would that be okay? He said, nope, lying's wrong. And I said, well, I'm not going to be the one who takes you off this jury, because I wanted him and everybody else to know that when the bad guys struck him, it's because they didn't want someone who believed in honesty, because I was going to prove their clients were liars, okay? Well, at that point, I called him out. They can't very well say, oh, wait, you think lying's wrong? You can't get on this jury because we're going to be lying. You know, that doesn't really work too good. Doesn't look too good for everybody else. So they're stuck putting him on the jury. So he makes the jury. So now this is no longer a jury of 12 people. It's a jury of one. I got to win the Baptist pastor. So I decided I was going to quote scripture for the first time in my life in a trial. So I got up in closing argument, and honestly, I made this decision walking into the courtroom to deliver closing argument. I'd not decided it the night before. I was just like, you know, I think I may actually quote that Micah passage. So I stood up, said, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, have you ever heard the expression, preaching to the choir? They're all, yeah. I said, I feel like I get to preach to the preacher. I pointed at the pastor there on the front row because he was sitting front center on the jury. They all kind of chuckled. And I said, so the text for my sermon / closing argument is from the Old Testament prophet Micah, who in the 6th chapter, the 8th verse, asked this question. What does the Lord require of you? And then answered it, to do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly with your God. I said, that's what you're here to do. You're here to do justice.
And actually, that'll be the biggest act of mercy you could ever do, because these two fellows over here are 23 and 24 years old, and they have done nothing but tell lies for the last 2 weeks to try and get out of trouble. And we teach our children by third grade not to be liars. Somehow these boys got past third grade and hadn't figured that out yet. And the best mercy you can do is tell them right now, do right. Now, let me tell you why this is justice. And I launched into the closing argument. Now, the defense lawyer on the other side, bless his heart. By the way, that's a Southern expression. Bless his or her heart means you can say the worst thing about anybody possible. If you add bless his heart or bless her heart at the end, you get away with it. See, I mean, think about it. An ignorant pig, bless his heart, just sort of takes the sting out. So this defense lawyer, bless his heart, this was before I had much notoriety in the world, and he didn't know me from a block of cheese, okay? He just had no clue who I was. He had no clue that I had translated the Bible, in essence, for college, that I spent my time reading it, learning it, memorizing it. He just thought I was some local yokel plaintiff's lawyer who had found some obscure passage in the Bible and memorized it so I could wheel it out every time I had to make a closing argument and seem like I was somewhat biblical, when as soon as the trial was over, I would probably be out getting stoned or drunk and chasing my secretary around a hotel room somewhere, which many lawyers do. He didn't realize he had stumbled into a holy roller, for lack of a better way of saying it. So he stands up and he knows he's in trouble. He's thinking, what am I going to do, man? I'm in trouble. He's got a hook into that preacher. I got to do something. I got to reel the preacher back my way. So he stood up and he says,
ladies and gentlemen of the jury, were you as stunned as I was when Mr. Lanier quoted as he did from the Bible? Mr. Lanier quoted from the Old Testament. We Christians are people of the New Testament. Sitting there thinking, well, Jesus was Jewish, man. Cut me some slack. We Christians are people of the New Testament. So Mr. Lanier has quoted the wrong passage. The passage of Scripture that applies to this case is found in the writings of the Apostle John. Okay, now I had this moment. I don't know if you ever have these moments where your brain goes into rapid think mode. So my brain went into rapid think mode, and I started going through everything John had written in the Bible. I went through all 20-some-odd chapters of the Gospel of John. I went through 1 John, 2 John, and 3 John, three letters. And then I thought, just for grins, I'll go through the book of Revelation. And I can't think of where he's going with this. I can't think of anything John ever wrote that could even remotely be used, except for this obscure passage in Revelation where Satan is called the accuser of the brethren. Maybe he's going to call me Satan. But I thought, no, there's no way. There's no way he knows that. Now, all of that rapid thought happened during the time it took him to inhale. So recognizing what happened in my brain, let me go back to the scene.
Mr. Lanier quoted the wrong part of the Bible. The passage that applies here comes from the writings of the Apostle John. Inhale, rapid thought, continue. Who in a letter we call 1 Corinthians said, I bolted out of my seat and said, objection, Your Honor. Everybody looks over at me. I said, the Apostle Paul wrote 1 Corinthians, not the Apostle John. Judge Danny Sklar, a church-going man himself, crosses his arms, leans back in his chair and looks up at the light. You can see he's thinking, am I allowed to take judicial notice of that? Because it's not in evidence one way or the other. I think I am. Leans forward into the microphone and says, I'm going to have to sustain that objection. It was the Apostle Paul, not the Apostle John. Well, the guy just lost it. Fell apart, lost it.
I'm sorry to digress. Anyway, what does the Lord require of you but to do justice? The oldest and first law school you can read about in history. On Mount Sinai, where God gives Israel through Moses the law, the Torah, where God explains, here's how the nation of Israel is to behave. Here is the code by which the country goes. Here is the code by which individuals go. Here is the setup for the priesthood. He lays out the law. It's law school. And in the process of laying out law school, he talks about everything, including who judges need to be and how they need to judge. And in the book of Deuteronomy, the first chapter, verses 16 and 17, he says the following. Judge righteously between a man and his brother. Okay, that's easy. And the alien who's with him. Wait a minute. I'm supposed to give fair treatment to an alien? You shall not be partial in judgment. You shall hear the small and the great in the same way, alike. You shall not be intimidated by anyone. Don't let the powerful intimidate you. Trust me, the concern there was not when the poor widow woman comes and intimidates the judge. It's going to be the rich and the powerful, the well-heeled and well-to-do. This is the foundation, the earliest foundation and the clearest foundation of a concept that we have put in to the United States of America, a concept of justice for all. Doesn't matter if you're rich, doesn't matter if you're poor, doesn't matter if you're a citizen, if you're a non-citizen, doesn't matter if you're powerful, doesn't matter if you're a plebe. Justice alike. And that has been a consistent understanding in spite of the rise and fall of many civilizations. The year is 1215. The King of England is John. King John's got a bunch of landowners who are none too pleased with him. They don't want to pay their taxes. They're not happy with their treatment. They don't get any word in government. The king thinks he's the king and lords it over them. Literally. So what are they going to do? They confront the King of England off a little tributary of the Thames River. And the King of England in these negotiations agrees to sign the Magna Carta Libertatum, the Great Charter of Liberties. It was a deal that was brokered by the Archbishop of Canterbury. The Archbishop of Canterbury, Stephen Langton, said, I'll put together something, maybe everybody can come to a deal. And so the biblically trained Archbishop of Canterbury writes out the Magna Carta. And you see that little provision right there? You see, it looks like an abacus almost. It looks like a wire grate that you might cool your chocolate chip cookies on. Looks, see what I'm talking about right there? That's the way they made their capital N back then. That's your key. Let me blow it up for you. Right up there. Look what that says. Nullus liber homo copiatur, vel imprisonatur, aut dissociatur, aut ut lagetur, aut exultetur, aut aliquo modo. This says the following. You're not allowed. No man, no human will be deprived or be sent to prison or be disassociated from their property or will be deprived of
of their rights unless they get a trial to jury. No man. Now, it still had a long ways to go. Just says man, women, eh. But it was a concept of justice for all. Please understand, the king signed it, but the king didn't live up to it, but neither did the other side. So they continued to fight back and forth over this for the next 60 years until it was finally codified into common law. But it was codified into common law in 1275 that everybody gets a right to a trial by jury. Now again, let me tell you, let me warn you, that this didn't work out all of that well. The kings continued to do what the kings would want to do. They just didn't do it against the lords that had the power. They did it against the more common people. Hence, we roll into the 1700s, and here are the American colonies. And King George is not being very fair to us, and so our forefathers decide, hey, let's declare ourselves independent of England. And they fashion this Declaration of Independence. Now, there's a problem here. That's treasonous. Treason only works if you're able to win. If you win, it's called independence. If you lose, it's called death sentence. But they listed out their grievances and said, these are the reasons why we have a right under God to rebel against England. Among that list, King George has deprived us of our right to a trial by jury. Justice for all. And so it's something that we brought into America. And when Madison and others are sitting there thinking through everything post-constitutional convention, they realize they left out a couple of things and they draft the Bill of Rights. And in the Bill of Rights, the Sixth Amendment guarantees every criminal a right to a fair trial, and the Seventh Amendment in a civil case, a right to trial by jury. A fundamental right that says in America, there should be justice for all. But it's a strange concept, and it's one that's taken a long time to work out. It's one where women didn't have it for hundreds of years. With the slave trade, African Americans didn't have that right. Even with the Emancipation Proclamation, all the Jim Crow laws, all of the other ways to avoid justice for all are still being instituted. Immigrant populations from all around the globe don't get it. The Native Americans don't get it. We've got to go into the 1960s, 100 years after a bloody civil war, and you've still got Martin Luther King railing and quoting from Amos and Isaiah about the need for justice to roll forward. Because justice for all, the American idea, the concept, the goal was not being achieved. So we get the Civil Rights Acts, and we get the Jim Crow laws struck down as unconstitutional, and we get all of these changes. And that's a good thing. But has it achieved justice for all? No. We still fight for it all the time. How many of you have ever in your entire life been on the internet? How many of you in your entire life have ever downloaded something like an app or a program? How many of you read all of that stuff you agreed to? Other than Professor. How many? Nobody. Did you know over half of those called you to waive your right to a jury trial?
Okay, I'm a nerd. I wear the label proudly. I have no trouble telling you about times I've negotiated car rental agreements. But some poor person at the other side of the counter is like, why do I get the nutters? Saying, wait a minute, I don't mind signing this, but we're going to strike out this provision that I waive my right to a trial by jury and I am in forced arbitration. Well, you can't do that. Oh, yes, I can. Trust me, I'm a lawyer. All we need to do is draw a line through it, and I'm going to initial it here, and you initial it, and we'll be fine. Well, I'm going to get fired. No, no, you won't. If they fire you for this, you hire me. We'll own this company. So I'm telling you, they work. They work to strip you of your rights. The idea that a common, ordinary person truly stands on even playing field with the strong, megalith, multinational corporation that commands bazillions of dollars is a bit of a fantasy, but it's a fantasy worth chasing. So that's what I want to do next, is I want to chase that fantasy with you and ask you, what does it take to get justice for all? This is where I want to challenge you law students. I want to challenge you lawyers. I want to challenge my goddaughter, who is at Harvard in some master's program I can't follow, but she had statistics today, so it's related to that. I want to challenge us to pursue justice for all. That means justice in the court system. That also means justice in our private lives. I'm not saying don't have mercy. I'm not saying, hey, you stole from me, I'm going to chop off your hand. No, I'm not saying that. I'm not even saying an eye for an eye. I'm not saying you enforce your rights in that sense. But I am saying you treat other people right. You be responsible for your own behavior. I'm also saying you use the power of your job to stand up for the poor, the helpless, the defenseless, those people who don't have a voice. And what it takes to do that, it takes diligence. You've got to be willing to do it day after day. So I tried a case against Merck. And this is the first case concerning a drug called Vioxx. Vioxx was, what would we say, David? A pain pill.
Like aspirin.
Like aspirin. Like aspirin that's supposed to be gentler on your tummy. It just had one really negative side effect. It would give you 6 times the chance of dying of a heart attack. But hey, you could go out with your tummy not feeling upset by taking an aspirin. Although if you did have tummy troubles, they were much more significant and they'd kill you as well because you'd have a GI bleed. But hey, nothing the drug company felt was serious enough to tell anyone about. And so the drug company starts selling the drug. So I take the case on. We go try the very first case. $258 million for the widow, Carol Ernst. $258 million. Front page of the New York Times, front page of the Chicago Tribune, USA Today, on Good Morning America, on Squawk Box. I mean, all of the news media, this is a huge deal. Merck's in trouble. I go out to speak at a conference in Los Angeles. And one of the lawyers there, who's a real stud lawyer, comes up to me and he says, wait a minute, wait a minute, wait a minute. The rumor is you're going to try another one. And I said, I am. He says, are you an idiot? And I said, my wife has said so on occasion, but I don't know. And he said, I said, what do you mean? He says, you just kicked them from halfway across the county, right through the uprights. And I said, okay. He says, don't try another one. What if you lose? I said, then I'll be 1-1. He said, no, 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 no.
right now, you are the victor. Let everyone else try them. Eventually, it'll settle. And then you go out in style. And I said, it doesn't work that way in my book. He said, what do you mean? I said, we got to be diligent. We got to keep pressing on. We got to keep going. We got to stay on them. Muhammad Ali used to say, it was before, I think, his fight with Joe Frazier. And I don't do a good Muhammad Ali imitation, but it's really good in my head. He said, I'm going to hit him. I'm going to hit him three ways. Fast, hard, and continuously. I like that. That's what I do. I'm going to hit Merck in that case three ways. Fast, hard, and continuously. So we tried another one. We tried another one. And we just kept kicking them and kicking them and kicking them until finally they said, no moss. We'll settle. Please stop. Fighting for justice means being diligent. Don't give up. Pull, pull, pull on the rope. Do what you've got to do. Let me tell you what else it means. Sometimes you've got to defy the odds. Sometimes you've got to be that one that should not be there, should not be doing that. So Johnson & Johnson, they like to promote themselves as a family care company. They have this image of, gee, we're there for the babies. We make baby powder. We make No Tears baby shampoo. And in fact, even though the baby care franchise is about a hangnail of value for what they do, they call it their golden... Who? Golden cow. Their golden cow, calf. It makes everything more valuable. It's their golden egg. The goose that lays the gold. Everybody sees Johnson's and they think Johnson & Johnson, oh, that's a family company. Internally, within their documents, they play on that image. When 99.9% of their money, it seems to me, is made doing other stuff. They're in medicines. They're in medical devices. They're in areas you'd never dream of. So we got approached to get involved in talc litigation. Talc is a mineral. It's mined in the earth, from the earth. And it's ground up into a powder. And talc powder can be used for lots of things. They'll put stuff in it and use it for athletes' feet. They'll put nice smelling stuff in it, so you sprinkle it on your baby to make your baby smell like they think you should have your baby smelling. And then, by the way, that scent they recognize is of great value to the company because they think that that is evoked in the deepest recesses of your neural synapses and memories. And it's like, I'm an infant again. So, remember those good days when we were 1 week old and we had no worries? That's what they think it's going to do. And so, there's this host of litigation for these women who have ovarian cancer. And they believe that it comes from talc. So they come to me and they say, would you take some of these cases on? You hate Johnson & Johnson. Johnson & Johnson hates you. And I had a few $1 billion or so in judgments against them, but let's not count pennies. And I said, let me look at it. So I called an extraordinary medical wizard, Dr. David Eagleman from Brown University, sitting over here. I said, David, what do you think about this? And David said, I don't know. He says, let me look at it. There are studies that go both ways. And, you know, maybe there's some platy talc. There may be an issue there. You know, without getting into all of the documents, I can't tell you for sure. But it's something that'll be a fight. I said, I said, but what about, there's got to be something. And David and I somehow in that conversation, I don't remember how it all came out, started discussing the fact that a lot of talcum powders also have small amounts of asbestos in them. We're kind of like, you know, no one's really tested the Johnson & Johnson that we knew of at the time. No one's tested their talcum powder, their baby powder, to see if it's got asbestos in it. We know asbestos causes ovarian cancer. Wouldn't that be something? So David says, well, it's certainly worth testing. So we looked, the best tester in the country on this is a guy named Bill Longo down in Peachtree, Georgia. And so we tried to buy some old bottles off eBay and, you know, wherever we could get them, just try to find old bottles to send to Bill to test. Bill gets them. And he starts testing them. Now, this guy's tested for everybody. He's tested for NASA. He's tested for, you know, auto companies. He's tested for lawyers. He's tested for, you know, hundreds of different folks. Great lab, electron microscopes and all the rest. So he tests it. First, he's got to figure out the right test to use to find the asbestos because you're looking for a needle in the haystack. He tests it, and lo and behold, it does have asbestos in it. And as David explained to me, it makes sense because asbestos is laced in the talc mines. When they mine the talc, they can't avoid the asbestos. Just can't be done. So we take those cases on. We've got no right to be in there. This is a huge company. This is a huge fight. And I went to the lawyers that were handling the talc cases and I said, man, we think there's asbestos in the talc. And they said, no, there's not. And I said, how do you know? They said, well, J&J told us there wasn't. I said, that confirms that there is. I have never known them to be straight about anything. Joking. So we took that case to trial. Now, here's the problem. The problem is there's a way to test and get any result you want if you're not honest when you test. For example, if you happen to be watching News 8 for Tampa, Florida last night on the internet, News 8 Tampa, Florida had a news story featuring moi. Y'all probably pronounce that the French way too. In Texas, that's just moi. Featuring moi. Moi. And it's an absurd thing. There was phosphate mining going on in Florida. Phosphates, they're a valuable mineral, but they were mining it out of the ground. And the mine scoops that are pulling out the phosphates are also pulling out radon and uranium with a half-life of 1,600 years. They would take the phosphates and sell those and make gazillions of dollars and then take the uranium and radon brought up from the depths soil and just use it to fill back in. So the radiation in these homes is 6 times the background radiation. And in the neighborhoods, it's horrendous. And so the EPA knows this, and the state of Florida knows it. So the EPA says to the state of Florida, oh, this is your baby. Y'all figure out how to do it. And the state of Florida don't want to deal with it, and they don't want to upset the mine company, which is a huge taxpayer. So you know what they do? They quit using the radiation detector that will detect uranium and radon, and they switch to the RadEye radiation detector that eliminates uranium and radon to sniff out nuclear bombs. And they go out to all of the houses and say, oh, no, this looks clean. This looks clean. This looks clean. Well, that means it doesn't have a nuclear bomb in it. But we sit there with that next to the real radiation detector, and you look at the difference, and you can see it. You can test around stuff. They tested around the asbestos. What they did is, and we did this in front of the jury, they took a bathroom scale, in essence. Metaphor here. They took a scale that measures in a tenth of a gram, let's say, and they tried to measure asbestos, which doesn't weigh even a fraction of that. Asbestos would be like a sewing needle. You take your bathroom scales and put a sewing needle on it, like we did in front of the jury, and it's going to say there's nothing there. You put two sewing needles on it, still nothing there. Add a pen. Add my glasses. I piled up a mountain of stuff in front of the jury on this scale, and it's still 0.0. And I said to the J&J person, so by your approach, there's nothing on the scale. Ah, but what if we use a jeweler's scale that measures to the thousandth of a gram? By the way, a sewing needle weighs 0.07 of a gram. You'll find that out, put it on there, and it gives it to us, and it'll tell us it's there. Now, what does that mean? That means that what you need to do is use the right scale. Now, there's another problem. The asbestos is a needle in a haystack. And by the way, the company had been told this in the 1970s. By the Colorado School of Mines, one of the top testing companies in the world. They said, hey, if you're going to test talc for asbestos, it's like finding a needle in a haystack. And there's only one test we know of that will do it. It's where you pre-concentrate. What does that mean? Well, it's like this. As I did with the jury, I brought in a bale of hay. Nothing like a good visual. I got a bale of hay. I take a sewing needle, and I stick it in the middle. And I said, now, we need to find that out if there's a needle in this hay. How are we going to do it? Well, the way Johnson & Johnson would do it is they would break off a little piece of the hay and stick it under an electron microscope and say, no, that's not a needle. And they would test such a minuscule amount that even though they had done thousands of tests, when I held up just one medium bottle of baby powder, we did the math. Do you know how many days of tests it would take for them to say, we've now tested all of this bottle? 3,000 years of days. So you got to have a better system. So as our expert explained, let's take this bale of hay. Instead of breaking off a corner, let's float it in a swimming pool or a bathtub. And then all of the heavy metal will sink to the bottom. Then let's scrape up the bottom and see if we have a needle. And that's the way you test talc for asbestos. You put it into a liquid that weighs the same, has the same gravity as the talc. Asbestos has a higher gravity. It's heavier. Put it in a centrifuge, spin it out. The asbestos is going to the end of the tube. Scrape the end of the tube, put it under the microscope. Voila! Asbestos. And we found it. It's persistence, it's diligence that makes a difference. I'll be bold. I'll tell you, I think in 10 years you won't be able to buy that powder anymore. I hope that it's sooner. I go to trial in 2 weeks in the opioid epidemic. Opioids kill more people right now than car wrecks, car accidents in Ohio. The opioid case is like this multi-headed hydra. You cut off one head and several more appear. It's an amazingly complicated piece of litigation that we're having to fight on. And the judges ask us, the judge, by the way, Dan Polster, great judge, is a Harvard grad, Harvard Law School grad. and just an amazing judge. But he's asked us to be very careful about making public statements about the case. So I'm going to limit what I'm saying because of that. But I do want you to consider keeping an eye on the way this goes down. Because there are some of the greatest legal minds trying to figure out ways that you can bring resolution to a case with dozens of defendants and truly thousands of different types of plaintiffs. And how do you get resolution for something like that? Because defendants don't want to pay one if they're going to have to pay thousands more. It's a real complicated mess. And it's testing the bounds of class action law and other laws that just weren't developed for such a type of case. And yet it's a case that's in the system properly and needs to be dealt with. Watch it. It'll be in the news huge. We've got another kind of case that we've started working on now. Human sex trafficking. It's a huge problem. You'd never dream how big a problem it is. There are truck stops that traffic in slave sex flesh. And these women who are trapped, some men, mostly women, who are trapped within this are at the mercy of their owners, for lack of a better way of saying it. And it's tragic. I'm trying to get where y'all don't have a neck attack looking. It's tragic. And the wild part is, if you start digging into it, they'll go to a truck stop, one of these truck stops where the truckers will stop for the night. They have the sleeper cabs at the back of the truck. And they'll pick whom they want. And they'll rotate the girls every 2 weeks so that the truck driver who's driving back long haul doesn't have to pick from the same girls. Has fresh meat, as he would say. It is appalling. The girls have trouble getting away. Prosecutors don't like to prosecute these cases historically. The girls don't want to turn themselves. They can't, but they don't want to turn themselves in. They get told they're just prostitutes. They're not. That drives them to drug abuse. It drives them to alcohol abuse. And if you are a runaway girl at the age of 13, 14, or 15, your odds are almost 50% you're going to wind up in some type of a situation like this. It's a horrendous problem that cries out for help. We're going after them. We're going after the truck stops. We're going after the hotels that allow this to go on. The airlines are getting better about it. The airlines are training their employees, their flight attendants, to pick up when someone may be human trafficked. By the way, they're not left alone. By the way, they're treated on the airplane. But it's another opportunity to do good through persistence and hard work. And you can't do any of this stuff without a strong sense of ethic. I think it's absolutely critical that if we're going to wield the sword of litigation, we wield the sword for righteousness and justice, not for injustice. I still lament the case, Professor, you and I were talking about, where I nearly, through legal skill, deprived someone of their rights because I thought I could win the case, that it was our fault. I mean, here was this story. There was a fella who worked at a railroad, and the railroad work is down here oftentimes. Now, this fella had about a sixth grade education. He was from Mexico. But he'd come over to the United States. He was here working legally. He worked at a railroad job. He had a wife. He had two kids in school. And didn't speak great English, but spoke pretty good English. But a sixth grade education. So he shows up at work one day and he goes to the train master and says, "I'm here, boss." Train master says, "Go throw the number 3 switch." Now, that meant go out to the number three switch, and you bend down. You bend down with your knees, okay? You bend down like this. Don't bend over with your back. You bend down like this. You pick up this heavy iron bar, and as you pick it up, it causes the heavy iron tracks to move on the ballast, to move on the ballast and to switch. And once you get it up to that pinnacle, you can push it over, and gravity will help pull it down because it's very heavy. So he goes up there, and he starts to lift it up, and it snags. He sets it back down as he's supposed to, goes to the train master and says, train master, number three switch is stuck. It hung on me while I was trying to throw it. Train master says, oh, all right, we'll go throw the number 5, 7, and 9, and that way we can move the train that way. So he goes out, throws 5, 7, and 9. Work, everything's great. Next day, shows up at work again. Hey, boss, I'm here. Where do you want me to start? Go throw the number 3 switch. Oh, boss, remember that hung up yesterday. Did it ever get fixed? Oh, yeah, it's fixed now. It had never been touched, never been fixed. So he goes out to throw it, and this time he picks it up again. It snags and hangs up again, and he herniates, blows out 2 discs in his low back. He's got to have surgery, back fusion, and he'll never be able to work again. He shouldn't be lifting anything over 15 pounds, no extended standing, bending, stretching, turning. So here's a guy who is making $45,000 a year, taking care of his wife and 2 kids with a 6th grade education in broken English, and he's now being told, hey, go find a new career. Take that 6th grade education with broken English, and here in your late 40s, go find something that's going to pay you $50,000 a year so you can take care of your family. And oh, by the way, it can't be physical labor. You can't stand for a long time. You can't sit for a long time. You can't bend. You can't stoop. And you're limited to lifting 15 pounds. In other words, his life as he knew it was over. Now, we had figured out that he'd been in a car wreck about 6 months before and gone to the ER and had his back checked. And I'd gotten those records, and yet he had failed to tell us about it in his interrogatory answers. And so I thought, I'm going to make this guy out to be a liar in front of the jury. They're not going to believe the rest of this. They're going to think that this happened in his car wreck. And so I'm taking it to trial. Jury returns a verdict, $550,000. I lost. My first loss. And I was driving home. This is before the advent of cell phones. And I tried this case about 3 hours outside of Houston. And I'm driving home. And I'm getting better at it, I hope. But I used to be, and maybe I still am, hyper-competitive. I mean, I like to win, but I really hate to lose. I'm driven by no desire to lose. And so I'm driving home and I'm miserable. I'm thinking, oh, why does everything happen to me? I lost. I'm going to have to go back and tell everybody I lost. I'm going to have to go back and tell everybody I got beat. Meanwhile, this guy gets to go home and gets to tell his wife he won. He gets to tell his kids that they don't have to go on food stamps, that they get to keep their house, that they can wear clothes to school. And it was my road to Damascus experience where I just thought, Lord, thank you that I did not win this case. I did not deserve to win this case. Heaven forbid I wield the sword of justice for injustice. So the ethics aren't there. Y'all have been more than patient. We've got about 18 minutes. I can talk more. I got tons of stuff, man. I go for hours and hours and hours. Instead, I thought I'd just sort of show you a couple of really good slides to make you inspired. How about this one? Here it is. Be authentic. Be who you are. People can smell a fake. This is all part of how you get justice. Be who you are. This is the practical part that I'm not getting into. But if you ever have a trial ad professor who will let me come speak to your trial ad class, I'll explain how I do this. People can smell a fake even if he's well disguised. So you need to do that. You need to be able to multitask. You got to be able to handle stress. If you can't handle stress, you're in trouble. And maybe one more that I'll give you before we close is you need vision. You need to see things not as the way they are, but the way they could be. Because if you can see things as the way they can be, you can then work to try to get them there. And when you do that, you hit that third level, the fruits of justice for all, where everyone wins. And that's the final one I'll show you. So everyone wins. What are the negatives and what are the positives of us pursuing justice for all? Well, I got to warn you, it's a massive time suck. It does take time. You've got to be careful to protect your priorities or you'll get in trouble. I'll also tell you, you've got to be able to handle the stress. If justice for all is something you're going to pursue with your life, make sure you've got an ability to handle the stress. You plan that out ahead of time. Too many lawyers that I know of are stuck in a rut of their own making because they're addicted to pills, they're addicted to alcohol, they're addicted to tobacco, they're addicted to sex, they're addicted to power, they're addicted to money. And those six addictions have ruined so many people, and it is an addiction that is a way of dealing with stress. So don't get into this field and don't think you're pursuing justice for all unless you know how to handle stress. If you want to pursue justice for all, get ready because there's a great deal of travel.
You say, oh, I kind of like travel. You get to go where? You go to England? Ooh, that's really good.
Yeah, England's real fun for the first 20, 30 trips. And let me tell you, I've got great hotels all over the world. You name a city, I'll bet I not only tell you the hotel, I can tell you someone who works there who'll be nice to you. And I certainly have a favorite restaurant almost everywhere. But it isn't all glamour shots. You see, I got a case I had to try in a place called Snyder, Texas. Snyder, Texas, they don't have a Dairy Queen. They have a hotel. It was built in the 1960s. It's not a hotel, it's a motel. It had the same shag, pink shag carpet in it when I went to try my case that they put in it in the 1960s. I'm acutely allergic to cigarette smoke. I mean, acutely allergic. So I requested a non-smoking room in the only hotel in town where I'm going to have to spend the next 2.5 weeks. And I check in. Is this my room? Yes. Is it a non-smoking room? Yes. Thank you very much. I go up the stairs to room 212 or whatever. I walk in. I mean, you could cut the smoke with a knife. The smoke was so bad, I immediately shut down. I go right back to the desk. I said, ma'am, you're awfully nice, and I don't want to be that guy. But I'm sorry. Someone, I think you accidentally gave me a smoking room. She said, oh, no. I know. It's not. It was a non-smoking room. It's a non-smoking room. I said, ma'am, I promise you, it's a smoke. She said, no. I mean, I was there when they took the ashtrays out this morning. And I said, what? She said, well, yeah, it was a smoking room until you got here, but we took the ashtrays out. I said, what did they put in the water here in Snyder? No, I didn't. I said, well, what do you mean? She said, well, if somebody wants a non-smoking room, we take out the ashtrays. And I said, and then when I leave, what happens? Well, we put them back. I said, but don't you understand? That means it really has a lot of smoke and it stinks real bad. She goes, oh, I hadn't thought of that. I said, okay. So this is Friday night, all right? We're going to start trial Monday. So I check into the hotel. I mean, I get into my room. I mean, I'm like dying. Dying. I wake up the next morning, my whole face is shut in. My throat hurts like crazy. My sinuses are crashed. My eyes are leaden. My hair smells like smoke. I'm going in. I'm thinking, I got to do something about this. I got to get in a shower. I got to do something. So I go in to shower. I promise you, the shower nozzle is belly high. Like, I think I washed my hair with deep knee bends. Not that it matters, because there wasn't any hot water anyway. So I call April Krieger, was my trial assistant at the time. I called her. I said, April, we have cell phones. Yeah. I said, get to my car now. She said, now. Well, it'll take me 5 minutes. 5 minutes. 5 minutes later, she gets in the car. I'm sitting in the car, man. Windows are rolled down because the car is starting to smell like smoke. And I'm just dying. So we start driving. She said, where are we going? I said, we're going to Lubbock. She said, what are we going to Lubbock for? Lubbock's an hour and a half drive. I said, trust me, we're going to Lubbock. I'm thinking, what am I going to do? My parents are not in Lubbock. That's where they live. It's where I grew up. My parents aren't in Lubbock because they're in Houston helping watch the kids while I'm in trial. Oh, man, what am I going to do? I remember the phone number of my high school debate coach from 20 years ago. She's still alive. So I dial Miss Jarrett. Hi, Miss Jarrett. It's Mark Lanier. Hello, Mark. I haven't heard from you in years. I said, yeah. I said, would you do me a favor? What's that? I said, can you look up in the yellow pages for RV dealers in Lubbock? She said, okay. I said, what do we got? She said, well, there's Far RV on the Loop. I said, boy, that sounds pretty good. Is their ad a pretty big size ad and makes it look like they're pretty? Yeah. I said, great. Can you give me that number? Yeah. She gives it to me. I'm still driving. I call Far RVs. Hello, is this Far RVs? Yes. Do you have a salesman there? Yes. Salesman gets on the phone. Hello, salesman? Yes. Do you have an RV that's got like the car built into it type thing that's got water and a shower? Yeah, we sell those. It's called a Class C RV or something like that. David knows this stuff. I said, okay. I said, get me one of those. I'll be there in about, at this point, 30 minutes. So it's about 9:30, 10 o'clock. We wheel in. I said, okay, I need salesman Johnny, whatever. He said, okay. So I go up to Johnny. I said, hi, my name's Mark Lanier. I called you on the phone. You have what you called a Class C. You were going to show me. Well, we've got about 30 of them here. I said, just show me a good one. And so we go out there. He shows me a good one. I said, all right, this is the one I want. And he says, really? I said, yeah, now we got to negotiate. He says, okay. I mean, I said, no, I don't have time. I need this one, but here's the way we're going to negotiate. I said, I know you've got to make something, but I know you're going to want to make more than I want to pay, and I don't have time to haggle. So I want you to go talk to your manager, and I want you to come back with a sheet of paper that is written down to the penny exactly what you'll take for this RV. And I will not negotiate you. I will either say deal or no deal. I will either shake your hand or I will take that paper and hand it back to you and turn around and walk out the door and go to your competitor. Are we connected? He goes, okay. He goes away. It's like 15 minutes. He comes back. He's got a sheet of paper. It's folded over. I said, I'm ready. And he said, before I give this to you, he said, I really can't negotiate one penny off of this. And I said, I'm not negotiating. I'm either going to do it or I'm not going to do it. Well, he hands me a sheet of paper, and it had it down to the penny. And I felt good about that. If he'd said, you know, like $57,300 or something, I'd say, oh, yeah, like, no, it doesn't end there. But it's down to the penny, okay? And it's like 15% off what the list price had been. I think that sounds pretty reasonable to me. I said, deal. And he says, all right, well, it'll take us 2 days to get ready. I said, oh, no. I said, I'm going to go over to the law school and I'm going to work on trial, but I'll be back here. I'll give you till 2 p.m. He says, well, we can't get it all. I said, yes, you can. You want the sale, you get it ready. He says, okay. So he says, but I mean, like, it won't have. I said, just get it ready and make sure that I can take a shower in it and get this junk out of me. So I go to the law school. I come back at 2. They take me into the finance section. I said, I'm just going to write a check. Well, they didn't know what to do about that, because this is back in the days where, you know, you can't like Venmo $75,000 or whatever it was. Right. So
I'm going to write a check. Well, the banks are closed. They didn't have a way to check to see if the bank's any good. And I did not realize how absurd it looked like for this guy to come in and say, hi, I'm from 700 miles away in Houston. I'd like to buy this RV, pay cash for it, just writing you a check. Take me at my word. It's a good check. And then I'm going to drive it off the lot and you'll never see me again because I need it now. And I realized that looked a little funny, and he went and got his manager, who told me how funny it looked. And I said, you know, I'm sorry, that didn't even occur to me. And he said, do you even know anybody in Lubbock? I said, yeah, my parents live here. I said, Carolyn Lanier, my mom, she started the food bank. He said, wait a minute, you're Carolyn's boy? I said, yeah. He said, to the salesman, he said, he'd be fine, just get his driver's license on that check. He turned around and walked out. I wrote the check. I drove the RV to Snyder, Texas, all to say the travel is not always exactly what you thought. The clients come in all shapes and sizes, but if you pursue justice for all, you can change the world and be proud when you say that Pledge of Allegiance. And with that, I'll throw it open for questions. Questions from anybody? Don't all ask it one. Yes.
How can we pursue this mission in a defensive side front? Is that possible?
Is it possible to represent the bad guys and still do this? Oh, no, you said defense side. I'm sorry. Yes, I do some defense work as well. A, you want to make sure you believe in the case. B, even if you're representing a murderer, that murderer is entitled to a fair trial, but be careful how you do it. And C, you've got to be careful. Justice is a playing field. You want to play in the playing field of justice. You will not be shocked to find sometimes plaintiffs think that they're entitled to the moon, the sun, and the stars, when they're really only entitled to a sliver of the moon. And so it's a righteous cause to defend and say, greed has gotten too much from you, and you're asking for too much. It's a righteous cause to say, what you're accusing my client of, maybe my client's guilty, but maybe my client's not, and let's have a fair hearing. There can be righteousness on both sides of the V, and I don't mean to pretend there's not. What else? Yes, sir.
When you're picking cases for your firm to represent, where do you kind of put the balance on how much money it's going to make and how good that is for the firm's success and the ethical standpoint for it?
Okay, so when I take cases on, I take cases generally for three reasons. Reason number one, I believe in the case, even if there's not any money. And you have to be careful how many of those cases you take or you go broke. But an example would be way back, When George Bush was running for president, and I'm going back, I think it's the earlier George Bush, when he was running for re-election and he lost to Clinton. I think that was the year the Republican National Convention was in Houston. And there was a movement at the time, a pro-life movement called Operation Rescue, which had been started by a fellow named Randall Terry, where they would go to abortion clinics and they would just sit down and link arms in front of the clinics and sing. It was a nonviolent protest. And so the Harris County DA decided he didn't want any of that going on, or the Republican National Committee decided they didn't want that going on during the Republican convention, which is Republicans at the time, a very strong pro-life party. And so it looked bad. And so they arrested four women. And those four women were arrested for sitting nonviolently at the door of an abortion clinic and singing. They put them in jail. The judge released the women on their own recognizance, which means you don't have to post bail. You just are a good enough citizen, the judge figures you're coming back. After the women were released, so there's no basis for doing anything except processing their paperwork, the Harris County jailers made them take off all of their clothes in a strip search and did a visual body cavity examination on them, which means grab your butt cheeks, bend over and spread them, that type of stuff. And then as the women were putting back on their clothes, the deputies laughed and said, that'll teach you to sit in at an abortion clinic. So we took that as a matter of principle
to get Harris County to change their policies. Not something we'd make money off of, but something that's certainly right to do. So that's one set of cases that you want to do. A second set of cases are the cases that you do because somebody's a friend. Are they a friend of a friend? Are their mom's bridge partner? Are they go to church with you? And you're not really going to make any money, but you just got to help them out because of who they are. And then there's a third set that pay the bills. And those are the ones where you look at it. You want it to be a just cause, and you do the analysis. How much is it going to cost us? How long is it going to take to win? What are our odds of winning? And if we win, how much will we win? And you do that cost-benefit analysis to make that decision. Anything else? Yes, sir.
How would you recommend trying to enact justice as a low-level associate in a firm where I don't get the opportunity to pick what clients I represent or even necessarily strategy as to how to do that? How can I best work in my firm?
Okay, so rule one would be don't ever let yourself lose sight of that goal. Because the problem is you get on that wheel, that hamster wheel, and pretty soon you start running and running and running, and you can real easily lose sight of that goal such that when you reach the point where you get to make those decisions, it doesn't really matter to you anymore. And you've lost the zeal of your youth. You've lost your first love, okay? And so recognize that danger. Don't let that happen. And then second, really try to align yourself in the firm with the people that seem to have a heart for justice, with people who seem to know the difference between right and wrong. And you'll find some people at the firm who know that, if it's a good-sized firm. You'll find some people at the firm who don't care. And so you want to be the one who finds the people, who works with the people who care about that. And you latch on to it. And then you've protected yourself until you're in control. And to the extent you're not in control, you try to ride around with people who have that passion. Anything else? Last question. Going, Joni.
So in CivPro, we learned recently about the BMS decision.
Uh-huh.
I was curious if you could speak about that and how it affects the ability of people to seek justice as plaintiffs.
All right. So BMS is the abbreviation for Bristol-Myers Squibb. It's a decision that was handed down by the U.S. Supreme Court. It came out of California. And here's what it says. If you want to sue a company in California, say Bristol-Myers Squibb, you have to establish jurisdiction over them, not just a general jurisdiction, but you have to show that it's proper to bring the case, that they could reasonably expect to be sued in California, that they have done enough within that state to invoke this idea that it's appropriate to sue them there. Now, historically, that's been done by showing that they sell their product all over the place. But in the Bristol-Myers decision, the majority of the court said simply selling your product in a state is not enough to invoke jurisdiction. You've got to do more than that. Now, what does that mean? That means it's really, really difficult to get justice for certain clients. Let me give you an example. You've got a client who is exposed to 5 different asbestos products and develops asbestos mesothelioma cancer. So you want to bring a lawsuit. But 2 of those products he was exposed to, or she was exposed to in Illinois. 2 of them they were exposed to in New York. 1 of them they were exposed to in Iowa. So how do you bring that if you can't bring them all together in one place? How are you going to do it? It's a real difficult situation. It puts you in a near impossible situation. Now, I understand some of the reasoning behind it. We live in an Amazon age where you can buy anything in any state. And so just selling in a state shouldn't necessarily invoke jurisdiction of the state. But there are some wrinkles that need to be ironed out because BMS right now, as it sits, is very unfair to the victims. And that's one of the problems of justice for all. You've got to not only convince a jury, but you've got a judge, then you've got an appellate court, then you've got another appellate court. And more and more and more, I think during the Trump administration, you're seeing this. I'm sure you saw it in the Obama administration. But the appointed judges are almost routinely now appointed for political reasons and not because they are this idea of judicial fairness. They come in with an agenda, and that agenda rarely is justice for all. It's an agenda that's driven by politics of the left or right, to the chagrin of the system. Okay? Thank you, guys. Good fortune in what you do.